Good. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me back this morning on this beautiful fall morning. And I want to give you part two of a two-part series on the subject of creation and evolution. And today's talk is Cellular Complexity, Evidence of Creation. Before I do that, though, I want to interrupt my talk to bring something to your attention that I feel is something that the church needs to address. It's a theological issue that of concern to me, and it has to do with our elevator. I don't know if any of you have ridden an elevator lately, but you know, elevators always have a placard there with the capacity and who made it and stuff like that. And I had occasion to ride in our elevator a couple weeks ago, and I must tell you, I was shocked. I was just shocked. And so here's a picture of what I saw on the wall there. The placard says "Evolution by National Wheelometer, capacity 1,400 pounds, et cetera, et cetera." And so I was surprised to see this in our elevator, because that means anytime you go on the elevator to use it, you have to put your trust in evolution. You have to believe in evolution, and that doesn't seem right for this church here. So, as any good church member does when they're upset, they contact the pastor, right? So, I had an email exchange with the pastor, and here's that exchange. Okay, to Patrick Hines, that says, "Subject: Evolution at church. Pastor, I was shocked at what I saw in our church elevator." Steve. And he promptly replied. Here's his reply. Yeah, I see. It started out as just a wooden seat with ropes and a pulley. And it's been getting more and more complicated and better. Millions of elevators have died to bring us this much more sophisticated one with electricity. Okay, so that's why we have an elevator, and it's a little bit of evidence for evolution, possibly. But anyhow, I hope that our church leaders will address this serious theological issue, and maybe somebody can think up of a clever sign to put next to it, because, you know, if a visitor were to see that, you know, what would they think about our church? Okay? Okay, so that's got that off my chest. Now we can proceed into my talk about cellular complexity. Okay, this is my title slide is called "Cellular Complexity: Evidence of Creation," and this is a subject that I really love. I'm really into the creation evolution debate and seeing the beauty of God's creation. To me, when I see nature, the world around me, I'm just in awe of our amazing Creator and His creative intelligence, the creative abilities, the amazing complexity of life. On this slide are a few pictures that I picked up off the internet, some particularly beautiful photographs of animals. And I didn't take any of these pictures except the center one of the caterpillar. Can anybody identify what kind of caterpillar that is? It's the caterpillar that turns into a monarch butterfly. I had occasion to caterpillar sit for some friends that were raising monarch butterflies, and so I got to see the process of metamorphosis from this caterpillar into a butterfly. And metamorphosis is an amazing thing. For an evolutionist to explain how a creature that crawls on leaves, has a mouth that chews leaves, turns into a chrysalis, undergoes metamorphosis, and then comes out a butterfly, is just an incredible thing. It's extremely difficult, really impossible to explain from an evolutionary point of view. So here's the butterfly as it first emerged from the chrysalis. It's all wet. It sits there drying. And it's pumping its wings to inflate the wings. And finally, it had this beautiful monarch butterfly that that I got some great pictures of and took it outside, and then it flew away. And so it was really a great learning experience for me. I enjoyed it very much. And it's the sort of thing that you might want to do with your kids someday, because there's a lot you can learn from that. Well, if you look at all these pictures here, these wonderful animals, the diversity that you see there, even the plants in the picture, we can ask ourselves, were these things created or did they evolve? Okay, I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me, I hope to you, that these were our created creatures and plants. But that's not the view that most people, that many, probably the majority of scientists have. The majority of scientists, secular scientists, atheistic, secular humanists, will say, well, all these things evolved over time by the process of evolution. Now, if I put a picture like this up there, and I could have grabbed any human man-made gadget or machine or device. I chose this picture of an airplane. Anybody know what kind of airplane that is? B-25 bomber. And if you were to ask a person, does this airplane, was it created or did it evolve? And say, what are you, crazy? It was built by men and women. It was designed and then constructed. It's obviously a created object. But I contend that every other creature on that implant on this slide is more complicated than the airplane. If you look at the molecular level of any of those animals or plants, they are more complex than an airplane. And airplanes, we build them all the time. It's a relatively simple thing to do now. So why is it that we have these different points of view, that some people feel that everything is obviously evolved, and then folks like myself, a biblical creationists see the hand of the creator in everything else. And like we talked about last time a little bit, it's a clash of worldviews. We have the secular humanists, the atheistic scientists looking at a piece of evidence, like, for example, the Grand Canyon. And they're looking through the lens, in our little analogy here, of man's theories. And they're seeing the Grand Canyon, well, that's evidence for millions of years. All those layers and fossils in that canyon are just evidence for great spans of time and evolution. And then, on the other hand, the biblical creationist looks through the inerrant Word of God, our Bible, and looks at things like the Grand Canyon and says, wow, great evidence for the flood. And creation is evident as you look at things like this. So we have this huge conflict between these two worldviews, and I know you all are very aware of that and feel it. I also used this quote last time because it fits so perfectly with these two talks. It's a quote by Dr. Carl Sagan. He was a professor at Cornell and other places, and he's deceased now, but he was an interesting man. He was a astronomer, cosmologist, a science communicator. He was famous during the 80s. He had written and narrated a science series on public television called Cosmos. And it was the most popular science series that's ever been done on public television. And he did a great job of making people excited about astronomy and science in general, but he was a secular humanist. He was an atheist. Although later in life, I read quotes from him where he said he was was agnostic, but he made this quote that fits in so well with these two talks. He said, "Evolution is a fact amply demonstrated by the fossil record and by contemporary molecular biology," and that's interesting to me because I feel like the fossil record and molecular biology is where the very best evidence for creation lies. And here, this other man looks at the same information, the same evidence. We have the same evidence, but we see the origin of these things in two opposite ways. It's just incredible. So that just really points out the worldviews that exist out there in what we're facing. And when you look at it, we talked about this a little last time as well, that if you boil it down to the really simplest way to consider it, there's only two options for the origin of life. Either it was created or it was not created. There's really no third option there. Okay, so this is a very bare-bones type way of considering the issue. If it was created, then everything, that means everything, every atom, is the result of actions by a supernatural designer, creator, using general terms here. The creation must have importance and purpose. That seems logical to me. If the creator created something, it must be a reason for it. And that nature, the world around us, the universe, the life, should show evidence of the intelligent design of the creator. Now, just to be clear, because I'm using very general terms there, that any intellectual design person might use. I'm a biblical creationist, young earth creationist, and obviously I feel the Bible identifies the creator. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And I also refer you to John 1:3 and Colossians 1:16, verses that are well familiar to you. Now, the second option, going back to our consideration of the two models, is that everything was not created. And so here, in that first point, we can say everything is a result of random action of matter and energy over time, i.e. naturalism and evolution. Okay, so to explain, the existence of everything is just due to the laws of nature, laws of science, just no, obviously, supernatural involved. Second point, life in the universe must have no purpose or importance. I mean, how can it be? I mean, it's just happened randomly, just random chance accidents created everything. So just to have a purpose, you have to have an intelligence behind it. And then concerning the design issue, I'm going to just use the quote by Richard Dawkins. He said, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." That's just an astounding quote to me. I mean, this man is probably one of our most famous evolutionists of this time. And he makes these outlandish statements like this one. He's very anti-Christian, very critical of us. And he loves making these really absurd statements or shocking statements because it sells his books. I mean, he's very rich because he makes these wild accusations against us. And so Richard Dawkins is a fellow that's deeply involved with the evolutionary debate and in making a lot of money because of it, really. Okay, but let's look at evolution a little closer here. What really is evolution? You know, we need to define our terms. And some people think that evolution is simply change over time. And if that's all evolution meant, then I say, well, I believe that. A lot of things change over time. I'm changing over time, not for the better. I found a book. This is the cover of a evolutionary textbook. And it had the title, Change Over Time. And even Dawkins, I think, would agree that evolution isn't just change over time. It involves a lot more than that. And so do things change over time? Do life forms change over time, like dogs? Do dogs change over time? Well, yeah, dogs do change. They change into other dogs. And here's a picture with a whole bunch of different breeds. They're all the same species. They're all related to each other. And they have resulted from selective breeding efforts of man over, say, thousands of years. But they're still dogs. They haven't turned into cats. And so it's like we read in the Bible. They reproduce after their own kind in Genesis 1. And so mankind, men and women, use selective breeding techniques. We can call it artificial selection, which is human intervention in human, in animal or plant reproduction to ensure that certain desirable traits are represented in successive generations. And so, for example, here's a Great Dane, probably weighs 200 pounds, and a Chihuahua, you know, kind of two extremes of the dog kind, and these are related to each other. They're still both dogs. What evolutionists really need to explain to support the theory is how you go from non-living chemicals to life at first, and then how life evolved in steps over time to man and higher animals. That's what the evolutionist needs to prove. And so we want to look at that, what they have to try to prove that. Now, most of this began, as you know, with Charles Darwin. Here's a picture of him about 20 years before his famous book was written. He was a naturalist and sailed around the world studying nature. And in his notes, he drew this picture. It's kind of interesting. You can see at the top of the page it says, "I think." And there's a bunch of scribbling, but there's sort of a stick figure there. I think it looks like a stick figure of an elk or a reindeer or something. But that's a very famous drawing. It's his first drawing of a evolutionary tree, of the tree of life. And he's talking about how species all interrelate with each other, how they're descended one from another. And so that's his first drawing that we know of that he made on it. I've seen T-shirts with that drawing on it. You know, you can tell where that person stands if they're going around with a T-shirt with that stick figure on the front. About 20 years later, he wrote his magnum opus, which is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. And there's a picture of him at the top left I inserted, showing him later in life, at the time of the publication. And below his picture is the only illustration in the whole book. There's a whole book written on the subject of evolutionary theory, and there's only one illustration, and it is an evolutionary tree of life, the phylogenetic tree. And so that's where everything began in the controversy of the origin of life. Now, here's a cartoonish, simplified evolutionary tree of life. Descent from a common ancestor was his term, and which tries to link together, like a family tree would, you know, how things are related to each other. But in this kind of tree, it's dealing with evolutionary processes. And there's a couple points that are really important. I really talked a lot about last time is the point in evolution of phyletic gradualism. And it says that complex life forms evolve from simpler life forms in numerous small steps over long periods of time. Okay, so in evolutionary theory, you don't have big jumps from, say, a reptile instantly into a bird. There has to be lots of little steps because it occurs by mutation. And these mutations cause little changes at a time, maybe even not noticeable at first, but the mutations have to occur over time. They have to be significant enough to confer upon the creature some improvement, some ability to outlive the competitors. He called it survival of the fittest. And so that the creatures that went on to pass on their improved genes are the ones that lived, that survived, that outcompeted the inferior ones. And so that's natural selection. So phyletic gradualism, these small steps caused by mutation, and then natural selection sorting through to find the best ones is a short summary of the evolutionary theory. Now let's look at Darwin's quote. Here he is late in life with the long white beard we recognize. He said, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." Okay, so this is good. He's done a good job as a scientist defining what would falsify his theory. What kind of information would you need to disprove his theory? Any good scientist should recognize that, put forth a theory, but also if these things could be discovered that don't fit with the theory, then that would falsify it, show it to be untrue or false. And so he's clearly demonstrated what's needed to disprove his theory. So we're going to work on using what he suggested is needed to disprove the theory. And I have two examples I'm using today from the world of biology. And I'm going to talk about the concept of irreducible complexity and then also about genetic information. First, what is the concept of irreducible complexity? Probably a lot of you have heard about this and know where I'm going with this. About 20 years ago, a professor at Lehigh University, Dr. Michael J. Behe, published a book called Darwin's Black Box. And this is a very controversial book. It generated a lot of debate on both sides of this argument of creation and evolution. First, what is a black box? A black box is something, anything. It could be a black box, or it could be, say, this computer mouse. Now, I don't know really how this mouse works. You know, it's full of gadgets, you know, electronics and a little laser and stuff like that. And to me, this mouse is just a black box. I don't really even care how it works. All I know is that if I push the button at the right time or slide it around on the desk, it does what I want it to do. So it's a black box to me. I don't need to know. I don't know how it actually operates. And so, you know, I get along fine just assuming that this will do what I want, although I don't understand it. To Darwin, the cell was a black box. You know, Darwin was alive before the advent of modern biochemistry and molecular biology. And to him, the cell, you know, was poorly understood. Microscopes were primitive at the time. And so blood was this red liquid, and not much was known about the blood cells, hardly anything known about the inner workings of the cell. Nothing was known about genetics at the time. And so for Darwin, a lot of science was just a black box. He could observe what was happening in a lot of ways, but didn't know really why it did happen. Well, Behe came up with this idea of irreducible complexity to analyze a machine or a device or something. And let me give you the definition here in the center. A system is said to be irreducibly complex if it has a number of well-matched components that all work together to perform its function. And if one component is removed, the system would no longer function. Okay, that definition is maybe kind of hard to understand. So I'm going to use the illustration that he used, which is a device, a little machine called a mousetrap. Okay, I've got one right here. And, you know, a mousetrap is a pretty simple thing. I added up the parts of it last night. There's nine pieces to it. You have the hammer that snaps. There's a strong spring there connected to the hammer to give it some oomph. There's a little place to put the bait, the bar that holds the hammer back. And there's staples, and there's the wooden platform. And if you've counted up all the parts on this very mousetrap, there's nine. And when you put the bait on it, you can say there's 10. Okay, so this is a pretty simple device. But if you consider that if I were to take away any of the parts of this, even if I use it like it is right now, without the bait, it's not going to catch any mice. If I were to take out one of the staples, it would not work properly. If the spring were not there, hooked up just right, it would not work right. Okay, there I've charged it. It's ready to snap down on a mouse. Notice I've even had to use a little bit of energy and strength and a little bit of knowledge or intelligence to cock it like that and prepare it for snapping. And so This is a very simple device, but if you take away any of those 10 parts, it's not going to do what it's supposed to. And if you don't cock it and bait it, it's not going to do what it's supposed to. Okay, so that was his illustration of irreducible complexity. You can't reduce the mousetrap any more than it already is, and it still work. Okay, hope that's clear. This is a very controversial topic. You know, the evolutionists have really jumped on this because I think it struck a nerve with them. They're embarrassed and concerned that they're making a good point here, and a lot of people from the evolutionary side are addressing this issue, and it's really kind of funny in a way that the scientists, the evolutionary scientists, will publish in their prestigious journals, you know, Science Magazine, Nature, and so forth, trying to refute the concept of irreducible complexity. And they'll refer to Behe, but they won't allow Behe to publish in the same journals. He has to publish outside, write books and so forth, because they don't consider what he's doing to be true science, you know, to be legitimate science. And it's really, very unfortunate and hypocritical of people to not allow him to participate in the debate as it should be done. I'm going to show one of my favorite examples of irreducible complexity, which is the bombardier beetle. Now, Behe looks at a lot of things in his book, which here's a copy of his book if you want to look at it and see if it might be something you want to read. He looks a lot at the molecular motors, the flagella of the bacterium, and the ATP synthase motor. Things I'd like to show you, but there's just no time. Instead, I'll use, for my one example, the bombardier beetle, because I really like the bombardier beetle example. And evolutionists have jumped on this example, too, trying to show how the bombardier beetle could have evolved over many millions of years in certain steps and how the parts may have come together. But I just don't buy what they're saying. The bombardier beetle is extremely complex, as you'll see here in a second. Okay, so the bombardier beetle is a ground beetle. There's over 500 species, evidently, and they have a really unique defense mechanism that they can spray hot, noxious chemicals at a predator from special glands in their abdomen. And I have a little video here. And I'm hoping this will work for us. Let's try to play it.
But the master is the bombardier beetle. It can create a chemical reaction within its body so violent that boiling caustic liquid explodes out of its abdomen. By pulsing the jet 500 times a second, it keeps its rear end just cool enough to prevent it being cooked.
Okay, so there he goes. The ants leave him alone. And looking on YouTube recently, there's a lot of other videos about the bombardier beetle and some other really good ones showing it spraying like that. And you'll find arguments on how bombardier beetle could have evolved there as well. I need to warn you about that. Okay, well, it's been extensively studied scientifically. They know a lot about the internal structure of the bombardier beetle, the chemistry of the bombardier beetle. Here's a famous set of pictures that show it firing. It can swivel the tubes of the spray in forward or backward. It can shoot almost any direction. The African bombardier beetle to defend itself against a predator. Now, here's a slide with chemistry and biology. I'll skim over the chemistry. You know, I'm a chemist and I'm an organic chemist. So this kind of topic really excites me because I relate to this. I did work in graduate school on the quinones and hydroquinones, and when I came to Eastman, I continued to do some work in quinone chemistry. In fact, I even went into production where we one of my jobs was to dry benzoquinone that they made in another part of the plant. And benzoquinone, which is the same chemical that the bombardier beetle uses to spray a predator or an attacker, is extremely noxious. We had to load wet benzoquinone into a dryer, and the men had to suit up in a complete suit, air supplied and everything. And I had to stay like 30 feet away to not get any of the little particles or fumes from it. It was, if you got any sniff of it, you'd start crying and sneezing and stuff like that. If you got a heavy dose, it would kill you. So it's a very noxious chemical. It has chemical uses. That's why we made it and sold it. But it's a nasty chemical. And in the bombardier beetle, it produces hydroquinone, hydrogen peroxide, and callus, which are enzymes that cause the hydroquinone to oxidize quickly to benzoquinone. It gives off heat and produces the toxic chemical. It also has catalase. It's an enzyme that takes some of the hydrogen peroxide, converts it to water, oxygen, and heat. So then you have, you know, all this expanse of hot steam, basically, that the bombardier beetle can produce instantly. And it does this in special glands and structures within its body. It has areas where it holds the chemicals in reserve until they're needed. And actually, the two reactants are together in the same reservoir. It's not until they're squirted into what they scientists call the explosion chamber, where there's enzymes that instantly cause these reactions to occur, producing the heat, gas, and water, and spraying out of it. So the bombardier beetle has some really exotic biology to defend itself using chemicals that are generally very toxic and difficult to handle, even in the chemistry laboratory. And so that's why I feel the bombardier beetle is an example of irreducibly complex. How could all these parts have come together? There's so many of them, and any part by itself is useless. Now, there's a few, like catalase is used in other parts, in other biological systems, of biochemical systems in the creature, and some of the other parts might be used elsewhere. But for the most part, the construction of the bombardier beetle includes all these systems that all have to be there at the same time, or it doesn't work at all. If it mixed all the chemicals without the explosion chamber, then the beetle will explode. If it didn't have all the muscles and the enzymes there at the same time, the bombardier beetle could not behave as it does. So there's all these different systems that have to be there at the same time for it to be viable. And so it's another, I think, a great example of irreducible complexity and the impossibility of evolution by slow, minor steps over long periods of time bringing the bombardier beetle about. Okay, moving on to my second example is genetic information as evidence of creation. And the question is, how do we normally recognize the creative work of an intelligent designer? Okay, we're going to go back down to the bare bones here and think about how we think about things. And in South Dakota, there's this interesting mountain called Mount Rushmore. And it's a very curious mountain. It seems, if you look at the top there, it kind of looks like there's four heads of resembling American presidents. I wonder how that could have come about. Is it the result of long periods, millions of years of wind and water erosion, lightning and freezing and thawing, maybe earthquakes? Or did all this combine over millions of years to give those faces up on the side of the mountain? Well, obviously not. And this may seem like a really silly example, but it's made this way to maybe make it memorable that we have we logically look at things and recognize if something is the result of a creator. Now, Rushmore is the result of intelligent design and skillful creation. There's the mountain as it existed before carving, and it shows a few pictures there showing the steps in the construction of the faces. One thing that's important to note here is that the initial mountain is complex. I mean, there's all these nooks and crannies and crevices and bulges and humps, and if you look at it, it's a complex thing. But the point is, it doesn't have functional complexity. It doesn't have specified complexity. It's just random complexity. Yeah, it's complex, but it's not functional. Doesn't relay information. Okay, that's a different important distinction here. If I take some pickup sticks and just throw them on the table, they'll be all randomly scattered about. If I were to throw the same set of sticks on the table and it in one throw assembled itself into a little stick figure of a house, you would think I had played some sort of trick on you, because you know things just don't happen like that. You don't see design organization occur randomly like that. So we recognize that functional complexity and information only come from an intelligent and skillful creator. Like we saw with the sculpture, we know there's a sculptor involved. And with art, there's an artist, obviously, music, a composer, a book has an author, invention has an inventor, software has a programmer. And I say that the creation, the world we see around us, nature, the universe, had a creator as the intelligent source. Now, how do we've been through the process in thinking about this, but how do we really recognize the work of a creator? Is it because the thing that we're looking at has usefulness? Here's an arrowhead. It has use for preparing an arrow and using it for hunting or whatever. But if you were camping and you needed to pound in a tent stake, you could pound it in with any handy rock. It's useful, but it wasn't created for that purpose. When we look at something, is it because it's organized? Is that why we realize that it must be the work of a creator? Well, if you look at a crystal, it's highly organized. If you look at the atomic level of a crystal, it's extremely organized, with all the atoms in a certain order. So organization isn't necessarily a sign of creation. A snowflake is extremely symmetrical and ordered, yet it's not intelligently designed, per se. Now, is it because it's complex? If something that's just complex, is that the thing we're looking for when we evaluate the origin of something? Well, that mountain was complex, but it didn't have functional complexity. Here we have the space shuttle. Some people think it's the most complex machine ever built by man. And obviously it was created. It has functional complexity to it. So, yeah, functional complexity is certainly a sign of a creator. But one of the best ways to recognize the work of a creator is, does the object have information? Does the thing contain information? Okay, now what do we mean by that? Well, when you look at a set of encyclopedias, you realize that there's a lot of information there. It had people that compiled and wrote the information in the encyclopedias. Encyclopedia didn't come about by an explosion in a publishing house. It had an initial author and an intelligent source. Now, but the evolutionists say, well, wait a minute, we have billions of years to work with here. Evolution over billions of years can slowly and gradually accumulate information and cause an increase of information and explain evolution. Well, I don't think that's a good argument, but it's used a lot. Here's a quote I'm going to give you from Harvard University biochemist and Nobel Prize laureate George Wald. He was considered the Darwin of his day. And he's speaking about the story of evolution in this quote. He said, "Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is of the order of 2 billion years. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless there. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. The possible becomes probable, and the probable virtually certain. One only has to wait. Time itself performs the miracles." Well, here's a guy that believes in miracles, but he believes in the miracles of the impossible going into the probable. I think that's just an astounding quote. We could chase a rabbit here all afternoon, but it's just to show that this point of view is prevalent. If you refuse to believe in God, refuse to believe there's a creator, then what other option do you have? You have to believe that it came about by random accident over time. But I contend that time and chance do not result in information. Information only comes from an intelligent mind. Now let's use an example. Consider new computer software. It's not created by randomly programming substitutions and deletions into the code. You don't set a toddler down in front of your computer with the code ready to edit and let it start banging away at it because, you know, probably, according to that theory, some useful changes will occur. You know, some useful insertion may be made or a good deletion to make the code more efficient. We just realize that's an insane way to try to generate new information by random insertions or deletions. For example, if we were to take this simple game, tic-tac-toe, and if we were to try to evolve it into a more complex game like chess using random changes of the code, how long would this take to happen? Over how many billions of years would it take by just random changes of the code to do that? I mean, logically, it would never happen. It's impossible. So I think we often think about recognizing that something is created, and it's just a logical way of thinking. We don't often stop to think what it is we're evaluating. Now, the astrophysicists are aware that information is what is a sign of intelligence. And I think the SETI project is just a great example of that. Evolutionary scientists believe that life must have evolved elsewhere in the universe. The universe is so huge, there's so many billions of stars and planets that surely if life evolved here, it must have evolved on a number of other planets as well. So the SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is looking for signs of intelligence coming from the heavens. So what is it they're looking for to recognize if they're getting an intelligent signal, a signal from an extraterrestrial intelligence? Well, it would be a signal, any kind of signal that contains information. Okay? Now, for example, Morse code, real simple way to by radio to send a coded message. So any kind of code like that, some sort of radio code that contains information would be proof that there's an intelligence sending that message to Earth. So the SETI program has all these radio telescopes looking and receiving radio signals from space, evaluating them to try to see if there's any intelligence behind the signal. And after many decades of searching, they've never found any that show intelligence, show a extraterrestrial source. Now, So my question for you then is, where will we find the best evidence for advanced intelligence in the universe? Is it using a big radio telescope like this? I say that we're going to find it with not the telescope, but the microscope. Actually, let me back up. I think the Bible is where we find advanced intelligence in the universe, but we're confining ourselves to the natural world here. So not the telescope, but instead under the microscope. And under the microscope, we see a world that's just incredible. There's a close-up of a feather, very intricate. There's a picture of a coccolithophore. This picture is a light microscope. You can only see so small with a light microscope. An electron microscope is used to see smaller structures, like these here. There's a mitochondrion in the cell. We'll talk about that more in a minute. And then there is this one. Does anybody recognize what that is? Let me blow it up for you. Anybody have a guess as what that close-up picture is? Okay, let me zoom out 10 times, four times, zoomed out. Okay, any guesses yet?
Is it a scale?
It is a scale. What kind of scale?
Butterfly wing.
What?
Butterfly wing.
Good. Yes. It's a butterfly wing scale. This is the dust you get on your fingers. If you handle a butterfly, you get that real fine, slippery dust. Slippery because I guess they're flat. These are close-up pictures of the scales on a butterfly wing. And, okay, I've zoomed out another 10 times. Now I'm zooming out 2.5 times to that. And then I know you would have got it if you'd seen this picture. And then finally the butterfly. This is called a peacock butterfly. And those scales are from are part of the wing. They grew. It's amazing to me to look at those things and realize that grew. It's not probably living at this point that I know of, but the fine details here grew from the in the life of the butterfly. So, to me, looking up at the world under the microscope is just an amazing evidence of a creator. The creative design, the intelligence behind what we see there is just to me just astounding. The Bible says that the heavens declare the glory of God, which is true. I think if you look down at the cell, they're shouting the glory of God. The evidence of the Creator, when you look at the microscopic cell, and especially the molecular biology of the cell, is just proof of the Creator that's just fantastic. And here we have a picture of a single cell organism. But a single cell organism, we kind of look down on them as being simple and not very evolved or not complicated in any way. It's not true at all. A single cell is extremely complicated. You could argue that a single cell organism is more complex than even a city when you look at what all is happening in it. In the cell, there are powerhouses that are converting fuel or sunlight into energy. Mitochondria and chloroplasts. We have chemical factories that are producing proteins, enzymes, hormones, energy storage molecules, and so on and so forth. It's like a little industrial world in miniature. There's a central information bank with data bank, and all the information needed for operation of the cell or to communicate and work together with cells in a multicellular organism. There's a communication system of sorts, sending messages in different directions. You can say there's a transportation system. I'm going to show you some of that in a minute. There are portholes regulating the import and export of raw materials and products and waste. And this is something that a city can't do. The cell can replicate itself in a matter of hours. Can you imagine New York City in 1 hour producing another New York City sitting right next to it. The cell is so complex, yet it can replicate itself in a matter of hours. So my question to you, thinking about the concept of irreducible complexity, how could this extremely complex, highly interrelated system be the result of random chance evolution? You need all those parts working together. Now, maybe you could substitute some or make some more primitive, and it still might work. And there's different cells that are, you might say, are more primitive than others. But you cannot have a cell unless you have all the parts together, all the parts working together and to truly live. Now, I want to show a short video. It's an incredible piece of animation. And let me confess up front, I don't understand everything we see in a video like this one and the next one. To me, it just shows the beauty of God's creation, you know, the intelligent design of our Creator. And it's just sit back and enjoy the beauty of what we see in the living cell. This is from BioVisions at Harvard University. And there's a narrated version on the internet that's longer. It goes too fast for me to narrate. I think I will try to stop it at one point to show you one of my favorite places. But let me just play it for you. It has some music that goes with it. That's inside a blood vessel. You can see the red blood cells moving along. There's a leukocytes, white blood cells that are traveling there, you saw. We're in an inner membrane layer at this time. Okay, that's where I wanted to stop. Okay, this is called kinesin. It's a linear motor, and to me, it looks like these 2 feet with combat boots or something, and it's walking along. It's literally walking along. And I should have said it at the front. There's an artistic license taken here for the colors and stuff like that, and maybe some representations, but what we're seeing here is true to the discoveries of molecular biology. The shapes of things, the way things fit together, is an accurate representation of the molecular biology occurring in the cell. They're animated because we can't see that small. Even the electron microscope can't see down to things that are that small. These are smaller than the wavelength of light. And so a lot of very hard work, molecular biology and chemistry, has done to discern the shapes of these things. A lot of X-ray crystallography went into understanding these organelles and these molecules. But this is called the kinesin linear motor, and it looks like it just walks along this microtubule down here, and it'll only go in one direction. There are other motors that can take it the other way, and what is dragging along here, it's kind of like the FedEx man, or Santa Claus, he's dragging this huge bag along with it from some interior portion out probably to the Golgi apparatus or to the membrane, and the bag is filled with some a protein product, probably, like hormones or whatever, and they're being taken to send out outside the cell or to use somewhere else. So this is the part of the transportation system inside the cell. Just amazing, amazing stuff that is occurring. And this is occurring in all our bodies all the time, billions of times every second. Okay, here's protein synthesis occurring at a ribosome from messenger RNA. There's protein coming out. There's a look at the mitochondrion. There's a protein going over toward it. There are the proteins being excreted through a pore. It's called the Golgi apparatus. There's the vesicle, the bag of chemicals being released into the membrane layer. That's a leukocyte, it's a white blood cell. It's going to a place of inflammation to do its work. It's slipping in between the epithelial cells there. There we go. There are other videos on that website. This website and others I show you are very evolutionary in nature, but well, I see, you know, just the glory of God with what they show us there. So my question for you is, what is the best evidence for advanced intelligence in the universe? I say it's a deoxyribonucleic acid. Organic molecule, yay! We're organic chemists. Yay! An organic molecule is the best evidence for an advanced intelligence in our universe. DNA. And the DNA genetic code is in every living cell. It contains information, evidence of a supreme intelligence of our creator God. Now, in case somebody wants to catch me on this, red blood cells don't have a nucleus. They don't reproduce. They don't divide. And they don't have DNA in them. But virtually every other living cell has DNA in it. Okay, DNA is the molecule of hereditary. It has two long strands, and I know you've seen this kind of stuff before. They're twisted together. It's a very complex subject that I'll just have to skim over. But all the genetic information, you know, like the blueprint and instructions for the organism, is encoded in this molecule. And this code is used to build the cell to produce proteins, which are the building blocks of life, and enzymes, which are the catalysts to carry out biochemical reactions. Now, there's a lot of ways to depict DNA. I really need to skim over this. The important point on this slide is that the DNA with these two strands that run actually in kind of opposite each other, they have what they call bases. They're heterocyclic molecules that can interact through hydrogen bonding with one another, and they give them the initials A, T, C, and G. And so those that A, T, C, and G are the letters of the code. And the bases of each strand are paired up together in a ladder-like structure, and the bases on one strand match a base on the other. A always with T, C always with G. In DNA. Okay. Oops. Yeah. DNA is our information storage molecule. It occurred to me that a long piece of audio tape or videotape has information strung out in a long strand, kind of like DNA has the information strung out in a long string. And it's important to realize that it's the order and type of bases that are on those strands that stores the genetic information. It's there, the information is contained in those bases and how they're used together. Now, DNA is the most efficient information storage system in the world. The DNA in every cell of your body, some 3 trillion cells I think I've read, has the information content of 3 to 4 sets of a 30-volume Encyclopedia Britannica. This is, boggles our mind. Now, in this computer age, maybe this is a better way to look at it. A pinhead of DNA could hold the same amount of information as 4 million 1-terabyte computer hard drives. Just a pinhead, okay? And every cell in your body, except the red blood cells, have this information in it that can provide the operating instructions, reproduction instructions for your body. So, my question here now is, how could this information and information storage system be the result of random chance evolution, even given billions of years, if you want them? Now, DNA is designed for replication. It, obviously, in order for any organism to grow, to live, it has to grow, it has to be able to heal, it has to be able to reproduce. So the DNA has to duplicate itself, have to replicate itself. And this is just some of the brilliant creativeness of our creator, designer, God, is in the replication of the DNA molecules. Amazing, just a wonderful subject to learn about and to study and to research. Just a quick summary view of DNA replication. I've taken this represents just a real short segment of the very long strand. In humans, they say there's like 3 billion base pairs in our DNA. And so these strands are very long. And this is just be a short one. And I'm simplifying it to just showing the base, like A, T, C, and G. And so we have 2 strands associated with each other. And they can come apart like that. And the beautiful thing about it is that they're complementary. The A's only go with the T's. The C's only go with the G's. So if you take those two apart and then complete each one of those parts, then you have an exact duplicate of the original one with the same complementary strands. And so that's how the genetic information can be replicated so that the cell can divide. It's just an amazing process. But to do just DNA replication takes about 30 enzymes to do it. Let me show you a quick video. Again, this is way over my head. You have to be an expert in molecular biology to understand everything we'll see here. But I just want to give you a taste of the, again, another animation. There's artistic license taken with colors and stuff, but the time, the rate that things are happening in this animation, the general shapes and structures are true to our understanding of molecular biology.
During DNA replication, both strands of the double helix act as templates for the formation of new DNA molecules. Copying occurs at a localized region called the replication fork, which is a Y-shaped structure where new DNA strands are synthesized by a multi-enzyme complex. Here, the DNA to be copied enters the complex from the left. One new strand is leaving at the top of frame, and the other new strand is leaving at the bottom. The first step in DNA replication is the separation of the 2 strands by an enzyme called helicase. This spins the incoming DNA to unravel it at 10,000 RPM in the case of bacterial systems. The separated strands are called 3' and 5'. distinguished by the direction in which their component nucleotides join up. The 3' DNA strand, also known as the leading strand, is diverted to a DNA polymerase and is used as a continuous template for the synthesis of the first daughter DNA helix. The other half of the DNA double helix, known as the lagging strand, has the opposite orientation and consequently requires a more complicated copying mechanism. As it emerges from the helicase, the lagging strand is organized into sections called Okazaki fragments. These are then presented to a second DNA polymerase enzyme in the preferred 5' to 3' orientation. These sections are then effectively synthesized backwards. When the copying is complete, the finished section is released and the next loop is drawn back for replication. Intricate as this mechanism appears, numerous components have been deliberately left out to avoid complete confusion. The exposed strands of single DNA are covered by protective binding proteins, and in some systems, multiple Okazaki fragments may be present.
Amazing. Molecular biology, the replication of the DNA molecule is just astounding. I have to really skim over this. The important point here is that DNA is used to manufacture proteins. The code in the DNA is used for various things, but the most important is to manufacture proteins. Proteins are the main building block in our bodies. You know, our skin, you're looking at protein when you look at your skin. Our organs, much of the bone, are made up of proteins. The catalysts, the extremely important enzymes in our bodies are proteins. And so there's a process that where the information goes from the nucleus of the cell, is taken out to a ribosome, and that information then through the operation of the ribosome is converted into a protein. We'll leave that like that for the moment. Now, this slide looks really complicated, and I guess it is, but I want to show the interrelatedness because it deals with the concept of irreducible complexity. Enzymes, as I said, are proteins. They're specialized proteins that cause chemical reactions to occur or speed them up. But enzymes are needed for DNA to replicate itself. Enzymes are also needed for DNA to send its message to the ribosome via messenger RNA. There's 12 enzymes used there. And then the ribosome is a complex of 50 to 75 proteins or enzymes that work in concert to take the message of the RNA and combine the amino acids to make proteins. And this is going on billions of times a second in our bodies, and then the ribosomes completing the circle were the ones that made the enzymes. So we have a severe chicken and egg problem here. Which came first, the code or the decoder? Now remember this quote by Charles Darwin. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not have possibly been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. We meet this this condition here. The evolution of the RNA, DNA, ribosome, enzyme circle is a extremely complex, irreducible complexity evident and could not have possibly evolved by numerous successive slight modifications. So as I said, we have sort of a chicken and egg problem. The DNA carries the code for synthesis of all proteins. Enzymes are proteins. Enzymes are necessary for building and decoding DNA. The ribosomes read this code and build proteins. However, ribosomes contain 50 different proteins. So how could the genetic code have evolved when there are so many interrelated parts? I don't think it's possible. By Darwin's own standards, the theory of evolution absolutely breaks down. This quote by Sir Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA, is interesting. He said, an honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. Now, to that I say he was almost right. Sadly, he died believing only that far. Here's a quote by someone that kind of sums up the other side. It says, even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. I couldn't disagree more with that. Instead, I say, no, we must seek truth wherever it leads us. If the evidence says there's a creator, let's go there. I'm already there, and hopefully somebody's saying, yeah, there is evidence of a creator. Well, who is the creator? Then we can take that next step. You know, Jesus is the creator. We learn about him from the Bible. So, my conclusion, point one of three, is that nature, and specifically molecular biology, gives abundant evidence of supernatural creation. And this, these verses from Romans are so relevant. Romans 1:18-20. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. My second point, building on the first one, which is nature and specifically molecular biology gives abundant evidence of supernatural creation. Therefore, we are God's creation, naturally and logically. And I like this verse to go along with that from Psalm 19. 139:13-14. For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, and my soul knows it very well. And then my third point of my conclusion is, therefore, we should seek, honor, and worship, and serve our Creator. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Now, if you're interested in any books on the subject, I can suggest these. Darwin's Black Box, very interesting read, talking about irreducible complexity. Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer. He's an intellectual design fellow. You can see how big this book is. It goes into a lot of detail, philosophy as well as the science. Great book on the subject. My favorite is this little one by Jonathan Sarfati. By Design is the title of it. And it has tons of information showing the topics I've talked about today, as well as many other things. It's subtitled Evidence for Nature's Intelligent Designer, the God of the Bible. Excellent book, a lot of footnotes, a lot of references, a lot of scientific information here. It's very readable. Anybody could read and get a lot out of this book, as well as the practicing biochemist or chemist would enjoy that book. So with that, I will wrap it up. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to address those now. We've gone long, I realize. So, any pressing questions?
I have one. So, all those animations that we saw—that's you said our bodies have 3 trillion cells in them. Those animations, what those were showing—that's going on all day, every day, in every one of those cells.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the most amazing ones I would have like to put in here is the ATP synthase. You can find all kinds of animations on YouTube. But ATP is the energy molecule of most living organisms. And it's produced in our bodies through an enzyme, a very complex enzyme that's a rotary motor, and it's an electric motor. It actually moves with protons and produces this ATP molecule. It's really the energy currency. It's a storage molecule of energy in our bodies, and it's going on constantly in our bodies. You know, billions of times every second. I've read somewhere that our body produces and uses the equivalent of our full body weight in ATP. If you were to add up all the ATP made and used in our body every day, it'd be almost equal to the weight of our body. There's that much of that chemistry occurring in our bodies. It's just astounding. And the animations of that will just boggle your mind. And didn't have time to talk about that. Yeah.
Those are just manufacturing processes. Will not ever have the technology to produce anything that efficient.
Yes, yeah. And
DNA repair. They are manufacturing processes.
They are, yeah. I think in those terms too. And DNA repairs itself, okay? If it makes a mistake, if it comes across a mistake, it says, oh, you need to fix that. It has enzymes to repair the molecule. It's kind of like having a robot that produces itself and fixes itself, and it does so, you know, once every couple hours. It's just, you know, unimaginable on the macro scale what's happening at the, you know, molecular level of our bodies. I know this has been a complex issue to try to communicate. I hope I've just shared with you a little bit of the beauty of ourselves, of our bodies, of life, to not appreciate it. I meant to walk in here with a single three-leaf clover and say this clover is more complex than any machine you've ever imagined. Just the, you know, photosynthesis is a subject that is just awe-inspiring to me as a chemist. So to me. Nature, the world around us, is just shouting that there's a creator. And the more I study it, the more I see that, and the more I appreciate our creator.
All right, why don't we close the prayer? Father in heaven, thank you for Stephen and for just his passion for this subject. And we're thankful for the things we've learned today. And we do see your glory reflected in the individual cells that make up our bodies and that make up all life on Earth. And we're thankful that you've subdued our rebellious hearts and have opened our eyes to see what we know from Scripture all people everywhere can see, but because of sin and because of an attachment to unrighteousness is suppressed. But we're thankful that we do see it and we rejoice in it, and that we rejoice not only that we know that there is a Creator, but that we know you personally through Jesus Christ and through his atonement on the cross that pays for our sins and reconciles us to you. Help us to live in the light of that glorious revelation and to always be astounded and awestruck by the beauty of all that you've created. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.